From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Remember, this program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you, and we are so thankful for that. For more information on how you personally can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday marks the start of the Hispanic Christian celebration of Posadas Navideñas, the journey to Bethlehem, and Wednesday evening is the beginning of the Jewish observance of Hanukkah. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Students around the United States are staging die-ins to protest the deaths of two unarmed black men killed by white police officers.
They didn't even think that it was worth going to trial and asking a few more questions.
A prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. Well, clearly a black man's life is not worth a ham sandwich when you put these stories together.
The concern on the part of too many minority communities that law enforcement is not working with them and dealing with them in a fair way.
From the streets of our major cities to the floor of the United States House of Representatives, an outpouring of outrage and activism continues in the wake of a series of police shootings of unarmed African Americans. And this week, we're going to take a look at what has brought us to this moment and where we go next as a nation and a society. Will be helped with some leading voices on faith, race, and social justice. I'm not going to be offering any answers here. I don't pretend to have them. But it has been impossible not to observe in recent weeks and months that a significant number of Americans see the protests as the problem and not the underlying long simmering issues that have led to those protests. It is heartening to see people young and old, black and white, of diverse national and religious backgrounds join together to raise their voices. An objective of this week's show is to search for productive, moral, ethical, and just responses to those voices. Now, what's off the table is hoping this will all just go away. What's on the table is a pursuit of wisdom, counsel, and the courage to break through the denial that has long pervaded our nation. It's a denial that polarizes, that excuses, and that leads to great human suffering. There is a direct line connecting the deaths of unarmed civilians in our streets and the kinds of brutality revealed at long last in the Senate Committee report on torture that was released this past week. It's the way fear and or hatred leads the most powerful to abuse those over whom they have power. And it has long ago been made clear that when abuse occurs, damage is done to the spirits, if not to the bodies, of not only the abused, but also the abusers. It's not hyperbole that the relentless politicization of these issues is sickening. Instead of recognizing at long last how far down the wrong path we've gone, too many are responding by impugning the motives of those they disagree with and implying that there's no consequence for dealing brutally with allegedly bad guys. In reality, there is an enormous cost to each of us when injustice is done in our name. This was true in the civil rights era. It's true in the streets of our cities. And it's true in the secret prisons funded by you and by me. So that's the challenge, as I see it, to rise up against denial and to do it in the spirit of common humanity, not political polarization. Joining me during the next hour will be civil rights legend, the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr., Senior Pastor Emeritus of Riverside Church in New York City. I'll also talk with Rabbi Jill Jacobs, Executive Director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, who was arrested during a New York protest this past week. And you'll hear from Bishop Stacy Sauls, who leads reconciliation efforts in the Episcopal Church. I'm confident that we are going to learn much from this week's guests. And I can assure you that we will continue to respond as responsibly as we can to this historic moment for our nation.
Thousands of protesters have been taking to the streets in New York City, demanding justice and accountability.
Rabbi Jill Jacobs is the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. I'm very proud to have known Jill initially as a fellow at Interfaith Alliance, and very, very proud of the work that she's been doing all of the years since then. This past week, Rabbi Jacobs was arrested during a street protest in New York City, along with several other faith and secular leaders. Jill, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. It's really wonderful to speak with you again. And that summer, more than 10 years ago, at Interfaith Alliance had a huge impact in the direction of my work. So thank you for that.
What compelled you to put yourself on the line like this?
Sure. In Judaism, the very first thing that the Torah tells us about human beings is that we're created in the image of God. And when the rabbis later in the Talmud talk about that, they say that, in fact, because we're created in the image of God, it means that anybody who spills blood, it's as if they're destroying the divine image. And they say that anybody who saves a single soul, it's as though they're saving an entire world. And the opposite, anybody who destroys a single soul, it's as if they're destroying a whole world. And so for us who are compelled by this idea that human beings are created in the image of God, we just can't stand to live in a world in which certain lives are seen as disposable, mm-hmm. in which often police officers will look at people of color, men, teenagers, women of color, and treat them as though their lives don't matter, mm-hmm. as though their lives aren't equally unique creations in the image of God, which of course they are, because Black lives matter, all of our lives matter. There are more than 20 rabbis at this protest, which included about 400 members of the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. We wanted to put our bodies on the line to say that we were willing to risk arrest because it's that important to insist that every single person in our world, in this case specifically people of color, are treated as the images of God that, of course, they, all of us are.
Jill, that is such a lofty vision that certainly creates a deep, profound commitment. But what is it like on the street when you saw that you might get arrested and then you actually did get arrested? Take me through your emotions on that.
Sure. Well, when we made the decision that we were going to do civil disobedience, we knew what the consequences were. It mm-hmm. wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. The people who chose to sit down in the street knew that we were risking arrest, and it meant that we were willing to be arrested. Mm-hmm. So we were waiting for the police to show up, and it took them a little bit, and they showed up, and they very calmly asked us to leave. When we didn't leave, they started to go to each person and arrest them. It all happened very calmly, and that made me aware of how much privilege we had. Those of us who were getting arrested were all Jewish. Some of us, as you know, were rabbis. All of us, as far as I know, were white, and the police were treating us really with kid gloves, very gently, very politely, not putting our cuffs on very tight. And I was aware of how different that would be if I were an African-American kid, a Latino kid. I was very aware that the police were treating me so much differently than they treat people like Eric Garner, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah. I was struck by reports of what you were declaring that day. I am responsible. Why were those words chosen?
Well, in the Jewish tradition, when we confess our sins, which we do on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, we don't confess in the singular. So we don't get up and just say, I did this, I did that. We confess in the plural. And that's a way of saying that we're in fact taking responsibility, not only for what we personally did, but for being part of a system in which there's injustice. There's a famous statement by Abraham Joshua Heschel that few are guilty, but all are responsible. That is, that being responsible for the racism in our society isn't just about whether I personally did something to perpetuate racism. It's about all the times when I didn't do something to stop racism. or about my being able to enjoy my own white privilege without being aware of what others experience. And so in that moment, we were all taking responsibility, not only for our own direct actions, but in fact, the actions of our entire society.
Mm-hmm. What hope can taking personal responsibility for police brutality offer other people in such a time?
What's been amazing in the last few weeks is that there's been a movement like nothing I've ever seen in my life, that we have people of all racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, religions, ages, out on the street every single night in New York, in St. Louis, in Los Angeles, all around the country. And that gives me hope mm-hmm. that people who perhaps have experienced police brutality, whose friends and siblings and relatives have experienced it, people who have never thought about this issue until this moment, who are all out on the streets together. And for me, that gives me hope that for us as a society, that we're finally able to confront the deep racism that's in our society and start to make some changes.
Mm-hmm. Jill, I'd like for you to talk about the distinction, if you see the distinction, between what you were bearing witness to, what you were saying in your protest, compared to the protests among what seemed to me to be rogue protesters in Ferguson and now some of the protests that are going on in Berkeley, which are not so much a statement about peace and justice and reconciliation, but are characterized by destruction and division and thievery and those kinds of things.
The thing that I think it's important to remember is that the vast, vast majority of the protests around the country, including in Ferguson and St. Louis, have been peaceful protests. Now, of course, when you have a peaceful protest and it is kind of boring, the TV cameras are less likely to show up there than they are when they get a picture of somebody looting a store. And mm-hmm. so the picture that we're seeing on TV is not reflecting what's actually happening. And that's what I hear from my colleagues, my rabbinic colleagues in the St. Louis area and from some of the leadership of the protests there who have been very strongly encouraging people to pursue peaceful means of protest. It's also important to remember that especially in Ferguson, the police have been acting in ways that provoked this kind of protest, announcing the grand jury decision late at night, in some cases starting to tear gas crowds when they are peaceful. So it's important to remember that what we see on TV is, of course, the drama and not necessarily reflective of the majority. And that's true of what I've seen in New York has been overwhelmingly peaceful protests, and that's what I hear from around the country as well. And I, of course, would never condone violence and would never condone looting or breaking into shop windows of people who are just trying to support their families. I do think, though, that it's important to try to understand the anger of some of the young people who are looting these businesses, mm-hmm. young people who have felt like they don't have any options in their life, who mm-hmm. feel like they're subject to brutality, who feel like they don't have a way out of their neighborhood. So I understand some of that anger and why that would drive some people to take violent actions, of course, without condoning it. And mm-hmm. I do think that our attention is best focused on the vast, vast majority of young people, older people who are engaged in peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm. That is so well said. How did the Jewish teachings come into your mind as you were actually doing the protest on the streets?
They were absolutely in my mind in a few different ways. The first is that in Judaism, we speak about obligations. So I'm obligated to do certain actions or not to do certain actions on the Sabbath, for example, or I'm obligated to live by certain rules when I think about what I can and can't eat or to say certain blessings. And for me, this action was also an obligation because we're obligated to protect the images of God in every single person. And so I was really thinking about that as an obligation, not something I was choosing to do. Mm-hmm. The second piece is that as a collective, we said Kaddish. We said the mourner's prayer for Eric Garner, for Michael Brown, for all the other victims of police brutality. And that was incredibly powerful to say that there would be 400 Jews in the street in the Upper West Side, the heart of Jewish New York, who are saying our mourner's prayer to remember those who have been killed. And that also felt like a sacred obligation.
Mm-hmm.
And our Jewish teachings also gave us strength when we were sitting in the police van, a number of us, the rabbis and some other members of the Jewish community, and we were singing some lines from Psalms, other lines that would give us some strength during that moment.
Jill, we're heading into the holiday season. Hanukkah is up on us. Put on your meditative hat for a moment and talk to us about what we should be thinking about and speaking about in our spiritual meditations that relate to getting on with the issue of racial justice.
Hanukkah is about bringing light into darkness. It's not surprising that just about every religion has some kind of holiday during this time of year when it's the darkest time of year. And for us, Hanukkah is about just lighting one candle and believing that that candle will stay lit, and lighting another candle and another candle and another candle to bring light into the darkness. And I think that really reflects for me what we've seen in these protests, that we never in August could have predicted that there would be a national movement with people out on the street every single day, and some real talk on the federal level, on the state levels, on the city levels about how we change these relationships between police and communities of color, how we protect communities of color from this kind of police abuse. So we are seeing that kind of hope. And I also think for the Jewish community, our holiday season is really in September and October. That's our intense holiday season, and that's a moment of tshuva, of repentance, of looking back on who we've been in the prior year and starting to move toward changing ourselves and our community. And Hanukkah, just a couple of months later, is for me the moment that we can say that we've gone through that process of repentance, of turning back, of recreating something in our lives, and now we're going to light these candles to say that we're moving forward, that we're creating hope.
Rabbi Jill Jacobs is the executive director of TRUAH, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Last week, she was arrested along with other prominent leaders during a protest against police brutality in New York City. Jill, I want to thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and inspiring us by the very nature of your ministry.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your leadership.
In addition to the role of individual faith and secular leaders in demanding a more just nation for people of all races, we need to consider what organized religion is able to contribute. Bishop Stacy Sauls is the COO of the Episcopal Church in America. He is also leading the effort at racial reconciliation within the church, and I am very pleased to have him with us today on State of Belief Radio. Bishop Sauls, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and delighted to talk about this subject.
If you would, let's start by you describing the efforts the Episcopal Church is making in the broadest of terms related to racial reconciliation.
A lot of what we do has been to concentrate on backing up the local diocese. Mm-hmm. And for example, in Ferguson, we've been very active in backing up the Diocese of Missouri, which is the voice of the Episcopal Church in that state and in that community. But we're also now looking at how we take the lessons that we're learning from Ferguson, from Staten Island, from other places, and turning this into a national conversation. These are really not issues about those particular communities. Mm-hmm. Those particular communities are bearing the weight of that issue for all of us. So now we have to take those communities and the events that have occurred there and make that a broader conversation and result in some action that's both national and local.
Mm-hmm. Is it safe for me to say that the Episcopal Church has been integrally involved in racial reconciliation for a long time, but this new initiative is being prompted by what we've seen in our homes through television and what we've seen in the streets of America over the last few weeks?
I think we started a little bit earlier, about 18 months ago, actually, in the aftermath of the Trayvon Martin case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe even earlier than that, if I could tell you just a brief story. I had a very wise African-American woman in the Diocese of Lexington with whom I was discussing this issue, and we were talking about instances of racism that had become more noticeable after the election of President Obama. And this is a woman who was in her 90s when we were having this conversation about 10 years ago, and has seen and lived through a lot, and she used these words, which I'll never forget, that she thought we were living in a quiet civil war. And I think the election of President Obama helped bring that to the fore, and then I think we've seen that in the Trayvon Martin case and the Michael Brown case and the Eric Garner case. Not anything new, but bringing something to the fore. And when this woman, whose name is Mrs. Smallwood, a great saint of the church, used those words, it crystallized for me that we needed to start getting prepared, lest the quiet Civil War end up to be not so quiet. And so we started gearing up at that time, and really the last few weeks have given us a chance to put into action the structure we had already started to develop. For example, about 18 months ago, we hired a racial reconciliation officer. We haven't had a position like that in recent history. And we also hired somebody to work on social justice advocacy, particularly at the local level. Both of which resources we were able to deploy in Ferguson and in Staten Island.
How did you take on this role?
It goes deep into my soul, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, particularly as a bishop, so it's less true in my day-to-day life as a parish priest, but particularly as a bishop, when my pastoral cure expanded to include people who were African-American and non-white, which is really the first time in my ordained life that had happened, I began to see the importance of the issues in a different way. I already understood them intellectually, but I was seeing them in a way of how they affected real people who were in my pastoral care. But the other one, frankly, is I'm a Southerner, and I am aware of how racial prejudice is part of the air that I breathed growing up. I didn't have to do to acquire it. I just breathed it in. And that, I realize, is a deep infection in my soul and something that I need to be healed of. So in that way, this is a very personal issue for me.
It's perfectly understandable for me because, as you may know, I share exactly that kind of history, and it brings an intensity to our concern, I think, that other people may not quite understand.
I think that's right. I also think it gives us the advantage of being able to recognize some things when other people might not see them.
Right, right. Bishop Saul, what have you come to understand about race, both within and beyond the Episcopal Church?
One thing I've certainly come to understand is how deeply pervasive it is. And how in the world we live in, which makes it more dangerous in some ways than the world in which you and I grew up, it's much more subtle. That's a constant challenge, just the awareness. We also, I think, are living, this is less true now than it was 6 weeks ago, but I think we live in this country in a state of denial that we have dealt effectively with these issues, and we don't have to deal with them anymore, that we're in a post-racial world. Quite clearly not true.
Yeah. What can organized religion do to further the work of justice for everybody?
I think we have an unbelievable opportunity presented to us at this moment, and I'm pretty confident that God expects us to take advantage of it. What the church is really good at is nurturing movements. The church itself is a movement. Its origin is as a movement. It is a movement before it's an institution. And in the civil rights movement, we saw the church acting effectively to encourage a movement. And I think we have the opportunity to do that again. We're located on the ground. We're present in all communities. The very essence of the church is millions of people spread out among their neighbors. What we haven't been so good about, and now I think we have a moment to change that, is in the crisis justice moment, like the rest of society, we've tended to come in the crisis, and then as time fades and people lose interest, we back off, just as everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think we have an opportunity to turn crisis justice moments into a long-term movement.
Hmm. Bishop, what have you individually learned in your work that would be valuable to the understanding of others on where we truly are on this issue and how far we need to go?
You know, again, I think I have to tell you why this is so personal for me, because not only did I grow up in the South, but my nuclear family now includes two children who are not white. They are Korean. And so I have had the experience in my life of seeing how this reality of American life has affected them. This is very personal. But one thing that I have learned from that is that as a white person, particularly a white male in America, that I come kind of ready-made with all kinds of advantages and privileges that not all people do. Nothing that I earned, it's just an accident of birth and being born white. The reason that is now seared into my consciousness is I realize I cannot pass along my privilege to my children. My children live a different reality. In my personal family life, that means equipping them differently. But what it sears into my consciousness is the reality of my privilege and what it means that it's not shared by everyone, including the two human beings that are as close to me as anybody could possibly be.
Bishop Sauls, when you look around and see what's happening today with the protests and the, it seems like, never-ending discovery of more indications of injustice, do you feel hopeful that we can move forward toward becoming a more fair and just nation, or are you a little bit skeptical about it?
I have to tell you, this may be incredibly naive, but I'm quite hopeful, and I can tell you why. For one thing, especially the Eric Garner case has seen people of different races coming together. That's a sign of hope, I think. But here's the bottom line for me of why I'm hopeful, and it really has nothing to do with the events of the last 3 or 4 weeks. It has to do with the events of 2,000 years ago, and that God promised this would be different, and I'm pretty sure that God intends to keep that promise and make it so. I do think we have to help in that. But the further I go in this, the more I believe that God's good for the promises God has made.
Bishop Stacy Sauls is the Chief Operating Officer of the Episcopal Church in America. He leads the denomination's efforts at racial reconciliation. He was formerly the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Lexington, Kentucky. Bishop Sauls, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It has been a great pleasure, and it's good to be working with you on this challenge.
Last week, as protests continued and the national debate grew even more polarized, I was honored to be able to talk to the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr., Senior Pastor Emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York City and a civil rights leader dating back to North Carolina in the 1960s. As a preacher, a prominent African-American leader, and a prophetic voice on the potential for all of humanity, Jim's words are very, very much worth hearing. Jim, were you surprised by what has happened, or should any of us have been surprised by what has happened?
Well, when there is a virus in your system or some other bacterial infection, what we really know is that at some place it's going to break out and manifest itself with what I would call painful symptomatology. Well, you and I are not, we're not naive about this. We know the truth about racial polarization, the impact of white supremacist ideology, and we know the impact of police community relations. In fact, it's been a miracle of sorts that we have not had greater conflagrations before. So right through here, I'm not surprised at all, nor am I totally dismayed at the emergence, since I have a sense that it could very well be that maybe this gets to be a Kairos moment in which that which has been the source of our alienation, separation, might now begin to be discussed. And maybe, in addition to discussion, there might be some structural critique and transformation. So, obviously, then, I'm not surprised, and I'm really hoping that what is going on will allow us to actually, sometimes for the first time in a long time, look at these things that have divided us and see if we can find a reason and a path towards reconciliation. Just today in the New York Times, there is a report of some union students that went down to participate in a protest. One was black and the other was white. When they were approached, the black student was handcuffed and put into the paddy wagon. The white student, even while being talked to by a cop, was told, "Get out of here. Go on." That is to say, one who was black was arrested. And for the same offense, the one who was white was urged to go. Yeah, and what you ask about a flashback, I distinctively remember that in my time as a youth, if a black kid even so much as violated a minor regulation, the result would be instant arrest. If a white student or a gang of white students were up to no good and very obvious, the cop would come along and say, "You guys know you ought not to be dead. Go home. If you're not, I'm going to tell your mama." Did you hear that? Well, that is to say, because you all are family. And it makes sense that we give special deference to family members. But what that does is it says that those of us who are black are not in the family. And the strictest response and the harshest response should go so as to keep us from, shall I call it, wrecking the warm, fuzzy family relationships that exist on the other side of town. That little paradigm is to say that, and I really loved Jim Washington, and he gave me this word called pseudo-subspeciation. That is to say, although we are all Homo sapiens, the same species, there is the sense in which there are gradations in humanity, and that we are sub, a lower cut of human beings. And if that is true, then it is understandable that we must be treated as the animals that people think us to be, and animals without the human respect that normally would be granted. So I think maybe it's no surprise that the great sin that George Kelsey taught us about in Racism in the Christian Understanding of Man was that a group of people dared to make an ontological decision that said, within the realm of beings, these black ones are a lesser breed. And it was God who made both the blacks and the whites, and who, I suspect, did not ask Adam to name them, but named the human beings God's own self. So that's a problem. And no matter what we talk about, at some point, somebody, maybe we have to dig up the ones who were in the Civil War or the ones who were slave masters, let them say, we want to confess that for our conveniences, economic and social and political as well, we dared to call what God had made less than that which God intended. And in that way, we ought to ask for serious forgiveness. And if there is any repentance and also penance that should follow that, we are happy to do that. And we will cease from looking at the symptoms of the subjugation that that kind of understanding led to. We will lament anything that is antisocial, anything that shows the lack of responsibility, but we will always understand that if we are the cause in many respects, then the response from black people even today must always be linked with who really set the framework out of which either responsible or irresponsibility emerged. Eventually, we got to get to that, but we're not going to get to it right away. Right now, and the benefit of right through here is that problem is so big and so complex and so hidden that it's a good thing that we now have at least one label, that is police community relations. It doesn't matter which one. They all are related to the same fundamental iniquity of human beings calling other human beings less than human beings. That all goes back to that. But here's a good place you can get a hold of it, because there's concrete data that shows the truth of it. But even if we get cameras, even if we have training, the reality is that our whole culture has to acknowledge that even when policemen act in ways that are unjust, they are simply carrying out the logic of the racial attitudes that have existed all these years.
We've talked about what kind of progress we've made in race relations since the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. How did we make that progress and fail to deal with the issues that you've just talked about?
I think we made progress because there is something unnatural about the racial caste system. And because of its unnaturalness, it is actually detrimental to the interests of those on both sides of that divide. And in addition to that, because it's unnatural, it is inconvenient, and as long as we had a moral sensibility, it, in a sense, was condemning in and of itself. And with the strong leadership from black people and white colleagues in the abolition movement, we, in a sense, pressed the moral button and were able to eliminate much of what had been the legacy of inhumanity around the slave or the Jim Crow existence. I don't find any cancer patients who had a tumor, who spends much time talking about how big the tumor was and how glad they are that they got it out. Most of them are worried about any continuing carcinogenic cells or tissues in their bodies.
What should all Americans be doing right now related to this situation?
Every American citizen ought to be reading Ephesians chapter 4, verses 25 through 32. Now, any of you the leaders, any of your listeners who are interested, let me say, in my looking at things, it's clear that that passage tells us, number one, that we must understand that getting rid of unrighteousness is important. So that's one piece. The other is that if you have become angry, be angry but sin not. That's one part. The other part is that you should speak truth to your neighbors. That's another part. And that those who are stealing should stop stealing. Why? Not because it's bad, but so that you can work with your hands and thereby have something to share with the needy. And otherwise, they need to know they got to be forgiven, forgiven in high heaven, but forgiven by their neighbors here on the earth. They must eliminate the attitudes which yield language and labels that are down-putting. So now, Welton, you know that that's a sermon right there, and I just thought I'd better share it with you because you're going to be preaching too. And if you do preach about that, tell them that the reality is, and this is the title of the sermon, between a rock and a hard place. And that rock is everybody has a commitment to the protection, advancement of their ego. And if they are people of faith, they also know that one of the first tenets of faith is if you're going to be a real disciple, you got to deny yourself. It doesn't mean you got to be into self-abnegation. It means you have to deny yourself the position of ultimacy. And that the real goal is to look out how you can serve yourself and serve your God and the principles of justice at the same time. To do both of those is like being between a rock and a hard place.
Jim, thank you again for being on State of Belief Radio and for giving us counsel that is about life and justice and reconciliation and peace.
Well, delighted to be with you always, and your questions and concerns always stimulate thought and cause me to re-examine where I stand so that at least I'll be growing towards that which God intends for all of us.
The Reverend Dr. James Forbes Jr. is the Senior Pastor Emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York City. With a lifetime of civil rights activism to his credit, Jim continues to lead and inspire as the founder of the Healing of the Nations Foundation. What a show this has been, talking about an issue of grave importance and getting words of wisdom as well as insight into issues that we have to better understand. Awareness of the critical issue of racial justice has been a part of my life since my preteen years growing up in West Tennessee and listening to leaders in my community warn of blood running in the streets of the South because of the Supreme Court's ruling on racial integration in public schools. Yes, we've come a long way since that time. However, the ugliness of the assumption of white superiority continues despite the civil rights movement, despite innumerable pieces of legislation intended to move our nation into greater compliance with the Constitution, and despite sensitivity to current strongholds of inequality across our land. The interviews that you've heard today on State of Belief Radio reaffirm a conviction that I reached many years ago. The issues of racial equality and equal justice are issues of the head and the heart, morality and legality. Much of the positive change that has occurred in race relations across the years simply would not have happened without legislation and law enforcement demanding change for the better. You know, sometimes it takes mandatory change forced by law to make people do what's right when by conscience they feel no commitment to such behavior. Of course, ultimately, one hopes that justice will become a preoccupation of the heart. But we can't wait for such a development to occur because of feelings. People are being treated unjustly. Sadly, history documents the reality that changes of the heart and will often follow changes in the law that cause a person to act in a manner that would be absent if the law didn't demand such behavior. On State of Belief today, we've listened to voices laced with passion and reason, morality and legality, justice and love. For those of us who care about this issue, those of us committed to a better relationship between the races and a more dogged commitment to compliance with our Constitution, we dare not give up on support for what is legal while trying to persuade and inspire people to act on what is moral. I commend to you a way forward on this issue, as well as a way forward on other crucial issues that bother us. The affirmed direction is implicit in an epitaph found in an old cemetery in England. It read like this: "In the year 1653, when all things sacred throughout the nation were either demolished or profaned, Sir Robert Shirley, Baronet, founded this church, whose singular phrase it is to have done the best things in the worst times." Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show, friends. I hope it's been beneficial to you. It's been helpful to me. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential for us to keep putting on the air this kind of show. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today as you consider your end-of-the-year giving plans. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief and share the stories you find compelling to you with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. If you like this show, you ought to be a part of this organization. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.